welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is a, he's not a bad cop, but he will do extra legal things to get answers.
I'm just, you know, I'm good at telling right from wrong, and I got some, I might have some anger issues, but, you know, I got a solid partner to keep me in line when I need to.
Hey, I saw you step on a man's ribs.
That was...
Don't you. Step on that guy's ribs.
She yelled at me, okay? I'll just, you know what? He makes ribs every damn day. He's going to make some more ribs.
And I saw you smash your car into a watermelon stand.
That was an accident.
Okay. Yeah, so this episode is the special episode for July. It will be... It's Cotton Comes to Harlem, the movie directed by the legendary Ossie Davis. Written by Ossie Davis and Arnold Pearl. We have special guest, Chris Funderburg from The Pink Smoke.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, so what's your history with Cotton Comes to Harlem or like Chester Hines?
I like the books that they're based on, the Harlem detective novels featuring is not the right word for a book, but featuring these two characters, Coffin Ed Johnson and Gravedigger Jones, that are in a bunch of books written by Chester Himes, in the 50s and stretching into the 60s. And I like those books. So I sought out this movie at a certain point just cause I had, been a fan of the books. And really enjoyed the movie as well. I don't know that I have any particular connection to it beyond I read them, I like them, mm-hmm. I saw the movie, and I like the movie as well. Although it's interesting the ways in which it resists and pulls away from what the books are and what this book is.
Yeah, it's an interesting adaptation. I read the book a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And watching it again, and like, oh wow, this is really toned down from the book.
The books are brutal, you know.
Yeah.
I was going to say that it actually, because I reread both Cotton Comes to Harlem and my favorite Real Cool Killers to do this, and you know, Cribs and I, John Cribs, who I do The Pink Smoke with, had read this book by Joseph Wambaugh, who's a former cop from Los Angeles. And this book, The Glitter Dome, there's a pair of really bad street cops who are like beat cops that are called the street monsters in it because they just love to be brutal and throw their weight around and are just kind of like malevolent people in this book. And rereading it this time, Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson are street monsters in the books in a bit of a way. They're people that really throw their violence around and, like, you know, shoot up the numbers guy's car just because he won't get out of the way fast enough and really just push people around and throw their weight around and are, you know, almost authoritarian in their actions throughout the books. And the books are incredibly violent, though. The Harlem of the books is way more violent and unsettling than it is in this movie, which I think is ultimately coming from the director Ossie Davis's more Black is Beautiful, Afrocentric point of view than Chester Himes' very wound up, angry point of view.
Yeah, like casting Godfrey Cambridge in it kind of immediately throws you into like, oh, this will not be a brutal, like, gritty cop movie.
Yeah.
It'll definitely be lighter.
Yes. But it's not, yeah. You know, and it wants to have a lot of comedy in it, and the things it chooses to keep and the comedy that it puts in it, and things that read as sort of like grotesquely human in the book, like darkly humorous, like gallows humor in the book, are turned into straight comedy in the movie. You know, like the aforementioned rib stepping is the kind of thing that, you know, is sort of darkly humorous in the book. That's just a straight up joke in this, you know, or when they get in like the physical altercation with the militants where that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that in the books is like tense and a little bit ugly. And again, they would throw their weight around. Here, it's goofy as shit, you know?
Yeah, it's still violent. Like, it's still like an action movie. Like, you see people die, but it's definitely like a more palatable, mainstream, I guess, version of it.
I find the action in this movie to be awesome, and the violence in the books isn't action. It's violence, you know? Yeah. It's not like action scenes, it's violent scenes. And this turns them into action. One thing that I thought was interesting, sorry not to cut you off watching it this time, just talking about the action, that initial car chase, the movie starts off with, there's a sort of like a scam artist preacher who's collecting money for shares and the right to get on this ship that he's building, a new Noah's Ark to take the black people of Harlem back to Africa, to the promised land. And he's a scam artist, and some people show up at one of his public appearances where he's raising the money and rip it off. You know, it's a van full of people show up with machine guns, shoot the place up, and take the money and bolt. And there's a car chase because there's tensions in the neighborhood between black militants and this, you know, oily, gross preacher. And so, you know, the Harlem detectives are there, you know. Gravedigger and Coffin Ed are there, and so they get into a car chase. That car chase goes down so many of the same streets from the French Connection, which would be made the following year, and it shoots right up those same streets, especially when, because French Connection is also in Harlem. That scene is in Harlem as well, but it just goes up that same highway, the Riverside Drive highway, and is just filmed in so many of the same places. It really felt like, wow, this movie was a big enough hit that I feel confident saying French Connection's a bit of a ripoff of it. The French Connection's famous car scene is a bit of a ripoff. It's feels like, you know, if there was I don't even know what to compare it to anymore these days, if there was a smaller movie and then in The Fast and the Furious the next year there were the exact same locations for a car chase, you'd be like, what the fuck, man? You know? So,
yeah.
But again, in the book, there's not like car chases like that. There's not like action scenes like that.
No, like the way it's described in the book is like a bullet like goes through someone's face and it like your blood and flesh explodes out, and it's like, that's not fun.
Yeah.
That's fucking ugly.
Yeah, or like when the guy at the very beginning of Real Cool Killers gets his arm chopped off by the bartender because he's pulled out a knife, because there's like a white guy in the black bar, and this guy pulls a knife on him, and the guy slashes the bartender, and the bartender hacks his arm off with the fireman's axe that he's got behind it. And the guy goes trying to find his arm because his knife is in the arm that got hacked off. And he says, when I find my arm, I'm going to get my knife back and slash you up again. And then he passes out because he's spurting blood everywhere. And he faints while he's trying to get his knife back out of his severed arm. That's the kind of violence that's in these books. And it's outlandish, you know, kind of violence, but also sort of queasily realistic. It has that ring of true crime, grotesque truth to it a lot of the time, the books. And I would say there's very little that I'd describe as grotesque in the movie.
In the book, I reread a part of it for this, but there's detail of the, who is it, Gravedigger, before he was shot up and he spent 3 months in the hospital and 3 months recovering at the beginning of this, and Coffin Ed had acid thrown down his face.
Yes, yeah.
He has skin graft. Yeah. And in the movie, that is nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, but that's also, I was thinking, was reading the books, it's that his face is acid scarred. It really drives home like the street monster idea. Like, they really look like physical monsters in the book. And they're described as being like big guys in the book and really throwing their weight around too.
Yeah. Like the book, I was surprised how much I liked it. I haven't read much like detective, like noir-ish story. I don't know. Not noir.
Detective fiction. You were there. Crime fiction, detective fiction.
I haven't read too much, but like this really like the struck a chord. I haven't. I don't know. It's very gritty and like funny, but in like a dark way. And this, and it's like the way it's written is just so over the top and ridiculous. Like there's some. Like I wrote down quite a few passages and took pictures of pages just so I can remember certain things.
Yeah.
Like is it in one of the in the scene in the book with between Iris and the cop, the white cop that she teases and embarrasses.
Yeah.
There's a passage that says centipedes were crawling over his testicles and ants were attacking his phallus. The odor of hot-bodied woman, wet cunt, and perfume came up from her and drowned him.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's like so just, it's just so over the top and ridiculous and just yeah. So like, not say strong, but just like kind of
pungent.
Gross.
Just it's pungent. There yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, to compare Himes to one of the obvious comparisons for Himes is Iceberg Slim, who's another writer who spent a long time in prison and developed their writing skills when they were in prison. Himes was in prison for, I think, almost 8 years, and Iceberg Slim for a similar amount of time. But Iceberg Slim, when he was in prison, wrote to sell the books and sort of trade them among other prisoners. His audience was like a prison audience, whereas Himes started cultivating a literary reputation and was friends with the people that were getting behind him and sort of supporting him were an entirely different set of people. Like Langston Hughes was one of his early facilitators, right? And he got in, like, you know, he hung out with, like, James Baldwin and Richard Wright once he moved to Paris and stuff like that. As opposed to Iceberg Slim, who, you know, was disreputable from the beginning. And it's fascinating to compare them because, you know, they are such different writers. They're writing in sort of similar eras, but they have totally different takes on it. And I find Iceberg Slim's books to be very almost sentimental and maudlin. They're very emotionally affecting books. They're like open wounds sort of books about these people. The criminals have been like, they're like overgrown children who have been robbed by the cruelty of their world of any ability to grow up. And their world is just purely exploitation and emotional misery from an early age. Whereas Himes's books are much more entertaining. They're much more fun, and the realism of them is in a sort of anecdotal way, that it's their well-observed details. Whereas I read a bunch of Iceberg Slim, and when it's not about his emotional life, it feels like a lot of bullshit that he made up for the books. You know, it feels like he's full of shit and stories that are like tall tales that never happened to anybody. Whereas the Himes books feel like real stuff grafted on to larger ideas about the world and his feelings about the world in this sort of more philosophical, political bent, which is very, very angry. It's very sort of presages the black radicalism of the 60s. It's definitely coming out of that same mindset of black anger getting channeled into social change that happens in the 60s, whereas Iceberg Slim doesn't feel like that much at all. And it's interesting to me that how their reputations have sort of flipped, where I think most people now think of Iceberg Slim as the bigger, more important writer than Himes. But I really enjoy Himes. And, you know, you haven't read much crime fiction. I think a good comp for him is Charles Williford, because I think they're books that are almost funny, that Himes almost writes comedies as much as anything. But you say that to a regular human being and they read it and they're like, this is so brutal and miserable. How could you say this is funny? Like, there's deformed babies being kept in shoe boxes, you know, like this is not enjoyable at all. And it's like, oh no, it seems pretty funny.
A little interesting fun fact about Cotton Comes to Harlem, the movie, it was released the same day as The Watermelon Man.
Oh yeah, and with also with Godfrey Cambridge as the star of both. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Which was the bigger hit? It had to have been Cotton Comes to Harlem, which was a fairly big hit.
Yeah, Watermelon Man. I don't know if that was a success or not, but I know it didn't do good things, especially for Melvin Peebles.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the, again, it's another thing where I feel like the reputations have completely flipped at this point where, you know, where Watermelon Man has the far bigger reputation than Cotton Comes to Harlem. But at the time, I bet it was flipped, would be my bet.
Yeah. But I will cover that in an episode in a month or two, actually, with Martin Kessler.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He wants to talk about the other Melvin movie.
That's interesting, because Martin woke up black one day, so he'll be a great person to talk to about that.
Exactly. Yeah, but it'll be on that and Melvin's first movie. What's it called? The one he did in France.
Oh, I don't know, because I've never actually seen it.
Oh, it's a really good, interesting movie about race and... and the effects of racism, even when you're not in America.
He's somebody I was telling you the off the air anecdote. He's somebody I also had to call to get a print from once, and and his answering machine, I didn't get a hold of him. His answering machine just went gone fishing. Beep. That was it. That was it on Melvin Van Peebles' answering machine.
So
super nice dude.
Oh. Yeah, he's an interesting guy with an interesting career. Yeah. But Joel, so what did you think of Cotton Comes to Harlem?
This is a funny movie. I didn't know what to expect, but based on just imagining based on the title, I kept waiting for Cotton to show up. Hey, where's Cotton?
That's what I thought it was too. I thought it was a reference to Cotton Weary of the Scream franchise. Just
or Cotton Hill, he killed 50 men in World War II.
100% pure cotton. Come on.
Okay.
R.I.P. I thought it was a lot of fun. It sounds like if they had made a version of the movie more similar to the novel you guys were describing, I wouldn't have enjoyed it at all. it's got such a fun pace, and it feels like almost like an adventure movie.
Yeah,
because of even most of the way through the movie, I didn't think of the two detectives as the main characters, because we spend a lot of time with a bunch of separate people.
Yeah,
what's going on? But at some point you do realize they are actually the good guys, at least better than some of the other people going around.
Yeah, the slightly better guys.
Mm-hmm. We actually don't want to cheat the poor people here. Anyway, yeah, good. I don't remember what else you were asking me.
No, that's your general thoughts on it.
Oh.
Yeah, I think calling it an adventure film is a good comparison in some ways. And it has a kind of a broad tone and a fun tone. It's strange. Right before I rewatched it again today to do this podcast, I watched Temple of Doom with my son, who had never seen it. And I was sort of struck by, they have like a similarity of tone in a funny way. Of just, certainly not a philosophy, but like a lot more comedy than you might expect, a lot of action, completely superfluous musical performance. I think that they have that sort of thing. Although, I bet Ossie Davis would cringe to be compared to such a blatantly racist movie as Temple of Doom, just hopelessly cluelessly, like, oblivious white racist kind of movie like that, you know? That, you know, a movie that a gravedigger would say, we've been trying to teach white people all our lives, school's over, about to, you know?
What do you mean Lucas and Spielberg are just trying to recreate the serials they loved as children?
Yeah, you know, I can't, you know, what can I say to it? What can what can I even say to that? It's interesting, once I went to a film forum, they did a screening of Goonies, and before it they showed the Little Rascals short that it's based on, which I had never seen. And it's interesting, like, they go into a cave and there's, like, a crazy deformed giant and pirate treasure and stuff, and it's very clearly the inspiration for Goonies. And it was one of those things where I haven't seen many Little Rascals stuff because they don't show it for a lot of different reasons. But goddamn, is it racist. They are just like, just like the worst, like, bug-eyed, I saw a ghost kind of shit with the black kids.
Like Manton Moreland shit?
Yeah, like little, it's buckwheat. It's straight buck. It's literally buckwheat shit. So, and like, you know, like... Little nappy-headed black girls and stuff like that kind of comedy that's, you know, right on the border between adorable and, like, adorable the way a zoo animal is kind of attitude towards those characters. It was fascinating. It was just fascinating to see that, you know, because you always hear, like, they're just trying to reference the serials and the shorts and things like that that they loved, and to place them back to back next to each other was like, yeah, I can see how they make those mistakes, you know. I can see how they, you know, give Chinese accents to fish people in their Star Wars movies, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, but
well, you know,
yeah, space fish people would have accents. I can't deny it. You gotta give them some accent. You gotta give Jar Jar Binks, who's doing, like, total jigaboo stuff, a Jamaican accent.
Yeah. We'll not talk about Star Wars, but so Godfrey Cambridge, like, the more movies I see with him, which is not that many, it should have been more, but more I see of him, it's just like, this guy was so fucking talented, and he was so funny, he could carry a movie, and just, he died so young.
Yeah.
Like, He died 6 years after us in 76.
Yeah, he was, like, in his early 40s, right?
Yeah. And, like, he was, like, a big stand-up, and he toured. He was, like, a big draw and shit. And he was in the Rod Serling horror anthology show. He did a segment on that. Night Gallery.
Night Gallery.
And it's this... Like, Like, even though, like, he's just naturally very funny and affable, like, when he needs to be a bastard in this movie, he can just make that switch, and it's like he's a bastard. A cop who will, you know, do a dirty trick just to get an answer out of someone.
Yeah. And just to tie it in, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that Night Gallery episode was directed by Spielberg, wasn't it?
I think. I did a review of it on the site I used to write for that kind of fell apart. And I don't remember. But I'm pretty sure Spielberg might have directed that one.
Yeah, I would have to look that up. Yeah, now I am. I just was like, let me pull that up before I say something ludicrous. Yes, it is. It was Spielberg that did that.
Okay.
I had that in the back of my head, and it was like, here, we can tie all of our Spielberg talk together. Alienate as many people as possible by bringing it back to Spielberg.
Exactly. And I know, like, I enjoy your talk about the comedy aspect of it, and, like, having, like, Red Fox in it just also just makes it go, like, this, like, changes the tone into, like, this is not gritty, this is a flat comedy. You got Red Fox, Godfrey Cambridge,
Cleavon Little, isn't it?
Yeah, Cleavon Little. And it's like, just having, like, the, like, two of the biggest black stand-ups of the era in it, this, you know, it will definitely be bigger and broader. But, you know, that's a good thing in this case.
Right, yes. But it's interesting that it's not like, look at the camera, I just made a joke kind of funny. It's it's really snappy dialogue and, you know, just kind of goofy, like, visual gags that happen real quick. And we're not, you know, there's no, like, sound effect or anything like that. Like, Red Fox's character is, he just seems like a kind of a goofy.
Yeah, he's grounded. Probably he's not this guy. Yeah, he's grounded. He's not comic relief like that. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I think the only scene to me that really stands out as, like, him being goofy is when he's negotiating with the junk dealer guy, and they, you know, but the way it comes off is it's like they've done this 100 times before. So, like, at the end when they both agree on 25 and shake hands, it's like, this is just what we do, guys.
Yeah. Yes. And that guy is great. That character actor is named Lou Jacoby, and I always really enjoy him when he shows up and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoyable. Yeah, but even that isn't, you're right that it's probably, I would say there's individual gags that are very broad, or like the scene where the cop gets tricked into putting the bag on his head and taking all of his clothes off, you know. Like, there's some funny stuff in this, or like the don't step on my ribs joke, or, you know, just some of the things are fairly broad, but you're right. It's not like a comedy. It's not like Beverly Hills Cop or something where there's like overt joke type jokes in it.
It's not like a parody movie. It's not, you know, Naked Gun or anything like that where it's like, ooh. I mean, you mentioning the whole the cop getting naked except for the paper bag scene. Mm. That one is a little at least after the woman Iris runs out of the hotel room. They do kind of like do a everyone's laughing at him from the hallway thing when he's just frozen there like, oh.
But I think that's also thematic. Yeah, I think it's thematic too, where I think this is about it's pushing a little bit idea about the actual helplessness and the illusory nature of the police's power, and that these cops don't actually have power over these communities in a real and meaningful way. And taking moments like that where crowds and mobs are completely unwilling to just submit to whatever the white police tell them to do, you know, I think is a thematically intentional thing for Ossie Davis, that kind of taking the piss out of the police and just showing that they're not in charge of this neighborhood is thematically part of the idea. And I think that's probably why he lingers too long on them going, wah-ha-ha-ha, there.
In that scene, I believe it keeps a direct line from the movie where Iris says, like, the badder woman, the
sweeter the smell. Yes, that is in the book. She's the character that I'd say survives most intact from the book. I think she's basically the character she is in the book. And you know, Deke O'Malley, the con artist creature as well.
Yeah. Well, in the book, he's Deke O'Hara. That's his real identity.
Man, it's no good. Yeah. Throw the movie away.
Yeah, like, the movie streamlines. Yeah. Seems like, because, like, in the
completely loses scene, the Colonel Calhoun character and all that.
Calhoun is in this, but not
him.
Yeah, but like, you get scenes like in the book. I think Gravedigger's daughter is in summer camp, and you get scenes with his wife and them talking about the case.
Yeah,
and like, I think maybe with Coffin Ed, I think he gets scenes with his wife too, but like, you definitely get more of the personal life in here. It's just like, you know, it's just an adventure movie in Harlem trying to figure out the cotton.
Yeah. Where's the bale? And we should mention to listeners that the reason this bale of cotton is important is that $87,000 has been hidden inside of it. And it's been found by Red Fox, a junk dealer, who just sort of picks it up on the street. It falls out of the escape van during the car chase at the beginning. So the movie is everybody trying to find this cotton and where it's gone and who has it. And what terrible dance numbers it's being used as a prop in.
Yeah, and that dance number is followed by, like, three women, three children, like, singing gospel.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very strange. It's very strange, the idea of, you know, the socially conscientious, mind-elevating striptease number for a general audience of old people and happy, smiling couples who are, you know, understand something about Africa now because she's in a, you know, takes off her slave outfit for a coconut bra. I'm not sure what it's trying to say, but we see a ton of this dance.
It was an incredibly deep, deep artistic, production. I don't see what the problem is here.
Yeah. That truthfully, that dance sequence is my only meaningful complaint about the movie. It's it's pretty whack. It's pretty butt, that scene. So
it's weird.
And he holds on it. He wants us to see it. Clearly, Ossie Davis is in love with this dance for some reason. Did it bother you, Spencer? Or did it bother you? I mean, it's obviously, it's also a good-looking woman getting naked, basically, so.
He hates that.
Yeah.
I'm just confounded by it, because, I'm trying to figure out the symbolism of it. It's like, there's a lot of mixed messages going on with this strip number, so I'm not sure.
And the song, "When Cotton Came to Harlem, We Kicked Cotton's Ass," what are you trying to tell me? The cotton is the money. The money is a metaphor for something to do with slavery that ties into the race hustler character who's selling fake shares to go back to. I can't follow this. What ass are you kicking here? I'm just not understanding metaphorically what butt is getting beaten.
And the whole dance number is called Cotton Comes to Harlem. So I don't remember if that's in the book or not, but I don't know.
No, I don't think that any of that is in the book. As far as the specifics of the dance number, I'd have to check, but I don't. I think that's all made up for the movie.
They don't end up at the Apollo.
Goddamn! Now I'm trying to remember what happens with the money. But they no. It's completely different because it's a completely different set of characters negotiating over the money in different ways. Very little of the dynamic of who's involved is imported from the book. It's basically takes the setup and one or two characters and does completely different stuff with it.
I mean, so that dance was it racist? Is that what I'm, am I allowed to assume that?
No, I think it's
the filmmakers and stuff like that. I don't know how to feel about that.
I think it's meant to be Afrocentric. I think that it's supposed to be, a Black is Beautiful performance.
Earlier she was talking about balloons and feathers are out of style. She needs something that connects to her culture.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, just knowing where Ossie Davis is coming from, I think that it wants to be a meaningful, populist, socially conscious piece. I think is meant to be the idea. I don't know if he's meaning to make fun of it. It's very hard to read because it's so tacky. So it's just very hard to understand how it's meant to be taken.
And this is a minor thing I noticed, but whenever women in this movie are wearing a lot of makeup, it's a lot of shiny metallic eyeshadow.
Yeah.
Which I guess that was in style at the time, but it's just kind of distracting a bit.
My favorite thing in this movie related to the women's style is that chain mail shirt Iris is wearing in the one scene when she's about to seduce the police officer. This completely bizarre backless chain mail thing. It's very bold. It's a very bold fashion choice on her part.
Mm-hmm. It really is something. Yeah, there's no use of the word mother raper in the movie, which
true.
I don't think. Because Joel, in the book, there's a lot of it's very violent and vulgar, but they can't. But they don't use the word fuck. They say mother raper instead of motherfucker.
Yes, a lot, and that's in all of them. That is used over and over in all of the Harlem detective novels. It's one of those things that you become aware of really fast, too.
And it feels worse if they call someone a mother raper than a motherfucker.
No, the first time you come across it, you're like, wow, that's messed up. That's fucked up what that dude just said. And then when it gets said another 20 times in the book, you're like, huh, I guess this is this book's version of Mickey Ficky. you know? Like, I guess this is just what they're going with. Because you're doing the Spike Lee podcast. Have you talked about the famous TV edit of Do the Right Thing, where they say Mickey Ficky instead of motherfucker all the time?
I know. No. We're going to close with Do the Right Thing.
I know. But that was when I was a kid, when I had to... Mickey Ficky all the time. Although the greatest is Die Hard 2, the TV edit of Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon. Doesn't get any better than that. Yeah, if it was Yippee-ki-yay, Mother Raper, you'd be like, whoa, John McClane, tone it down. There are kids watching this movie who have just snuck in out of what they bought a ticket for to see it, because it's R-rated. Or maybe that was just my experience. You all are much younger than me. You probably didn't sneak in with a ticket to Die Hard 2.
Joel, you weren't old enough to sneak in, right? That's early 90s.
Old enough to sneak in? What do you mean?
It's like 1990.
I mean, I was a good kid. I didn't sneak into movies, so...
You would have been 9. I was -1.
Okay, well... that's probably the ideal time to sneak into rated R movies. But
yeah,
I was
when you're still in the belly, so. I bet you could have gotten it no problem.
So, Chris, you talked about this a bit earlier. But does it make geographical sense, like the car chase going through Harlem? Like you live in New York, so like, does it make sense, or do you not like know that area?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense in terms of you know, where they start out. I don't recognize those streets from that long ago well enough, certainly, to say. But the way they try and get out of town, like where they're headed, makes a lot of sense. They start out in surface streets and cut through the cemetery and then go up to the road that feeds into the highway. So it all, you know, and they lose them as they're headed towards the highway. So it all makes sense as far as that. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be enough of an expert to, you know, pick nits with it. It's not like they turn the corner and they go to Brooklyn. You know, I was just watching Spider-Man Homecoming 2 recently, and a lot of that is filmed right in my neighborhood. The two different houses in here in Queens that I've lived in, a lot of it's filmed right by one, and the other's filmed like right on the bank, the ATM that gets blown up. That's on the corner of this street right here where he fights the guys in Avengers masks. Oh. And that movie has a ton of very recognizable, like, he walks around a corner and he's suddenly in the Bronx kind of, oof, that's a real jump there. And I think they, you know, action photography is something I find very endearing about Cotton Comes to Harlem. Interestingly, Himes was not a New York-based writer. He was a Los Angeles-based writer. And
yeah,
he
eventually left because of the racism for France.
Yep, moved to France with that whole group of that I mentioned before that was there at the same time. And like James Baldwin and that group. And he was from Ohio originally. He did his bid in Ohio somewhere. I forget which prison he was in. And then moved to Los Angeles, and he was actually, you know, on the strength of the stuff he had written in prison, he had gotten an agent and career and gotten a few things published when he was coming out, and he was hired by Warner Brothers. He was actually under contract working for Warner Brothers when, you know, noted racist and pile of shit human being Jack L. Warner found out there was a black person on the payroll and demanded he be fired immediately, and that he didn't want him seen on the lot, and that was like... one of the big, like, that tears it for me moments for Himes, apparently, that was a really formative, like, this has, prison didn't do it to me, my, you know, tough upbringing didn't do it to me, like, my experiences in Hollywood have made me really hate white people, kind of attitude, as he said that, and have real anger towards white people that was almost implacable. But interestingly, he married a white woman after he moved to France and had a better experience there where he was treated as a literary figure in France as opposed to just a, you know, a dime store novelist. Just a lot of the racial problems in the United States, you know, it's different in other countries. You know, I've spent enough time in Europe to not have illusions about, like, what racism is like over there and their level of enlightenment. I think it's just entirely different than it is here in the United States, but there's a certain kind of intransigent systemic institutional racism in the United States that is manifest differently in Europe, certainly. So I think that, especially in that era, where the United States was definitely lagging behind and was definitely definitely had more violent resistance to the social change happening, I can imagine that a place like France was a fucking breath of fresh air.
Yeah. So I guess technically this is like one of the first blaxploitation movies.
Yeah, I've heard it called the first blaxploitation movie before, and I don't know how you want to define that. I'm not enough of an aficionado to say whether this is. It feels like it has to be. I don't know what you would put in front of it, and it's impossible to imagine the black cop blaxploitation movies like Superfly and Shaft existing without it.
Definitely.
The sort of badass black cop blaxploitation films that were so formative. You know, I think it depends on if you want to call, you know, any of those movies from 71 the real first blaxploitation movies because they hew so much closer to what the genre is. That's probably fair, you know. I mean,
Sweepback is considered one, but I've seen it a few times, and it's like, that's not really a blaxploitation movie. That's more like a Godard type movie.
Yeah, again, it's like, how do you want to define it? There's a funny thing that happens, though, too, where if you go through what the definition of what an Italian neorealist film is, and then you look at Rome Open City, which created the definition, it doesn't meet the definition of neorealist. The most famous total inception of the genre doesn't really meet what people mean when they say neorealist, and sort of the more refined things it became. And so I'm no purist with any of that stuff. I think it's one of those things where, you know, is Texas Chainsaw Massacre the first real slasher film? It's like, well, it's completely different from the slashers that followed, but it's impossible to deny the influence. And I think that that's another way of looking at Cotton Comes to Harlem. It was a big hit. It got a sequel. It was one of the highest grossing films of 1970 and on a very, you know, modest budget. So it made a real impact, even if it's not one-tenth as remembered today as Shaft is, you know? Somebody who's more of a blaxploitation aficionado, I think, would have stronger opinions about that than I do. But if it's not the first blaxploitation film, blaxploitation doesn't exist without it, because I don't think Shaft gets made and gets positioned to be what it was without this movie.
Was Shaft?
Or Superfly.
Superfly was. Yeah, but was Shaft like based off of a book or anything? Was that just an original?
Yeah, I thought it was off a book.
Yeah, it's a Ernest Tiedemann novel.
Oh, okay.
And but I don't know what year it's from, and I've never actually read the book and have no idea what the books are like. And again, how closely they hew to the film.
Yeah. I don't know. I've seen a number of blaxploitation movies, and to me, I define it more as a set number of years. And I guess like more like the style of film and like when it was made. So like to me, like this isn't blaxploitation because it just kind of doesn't fit stylistically with Blackula or like Dolomite or you know stuff like that.
I don't know, but it's got. The soundtrack, it's got the location photography, it's got the black power themes.
It feels like it's hard to not put in the category,
but it's also clearly not.
You know, a full black cast was like such an unusual thing, so.
Yeah,
and a movie that made money because of that, or not necessarily because of that. You know, they made a really good movie, but black audiences embraced it. So you want to, I mean, it feels natural to try to shoehorn it in as something. But when I think of blaxploitation, I think of the movies that were specifically made because they thought, a black audience is going to want to go see this. It doesn't necessarily have to be good or anything like that. We've got these certain key features that we know they're going to be like, oh, I'm going to go see it because of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, too, where I will sometimes be surprised because I'll hear something like Uptown Saturday Night referred to as blaxploitation. I'll go, huh, I guess. You know, I have a tendency to think more along the genre pictures line, that things like Coffee or, you know, or Abby or something like that, or Blackula or Blackenstein are blaxploitation films. And it's just, you know, I guess there's no reason why one thing or another wouldn't fall into that genre. But sometimes titles listed as blaxploitation surprise me. But I agree with you, Spencer. This stylistically doesn't feel like a blaxploitation film.
I kind of hate genre. I hate that things have to be put into a category and then have to create an argument about that stuff. Like,
yeah.
Especially in a completely different realm. Like, I really hate when people have to argue about whether a movie is a horror movie or not. Like, I think as the watcher, I'll decide which one.
Yeah.
And if you disagree with me, that's fine.
Yeah. That's, I guess that's where I was going at the beginning of this, is like, it both is and it isn't, you know? I think I think you have to care more about the definition of blaxploitation than I do to answer that question. But I gave it my best shot.
Oh, Joel, do you know what other movie Raymond St. Jacques, a.k.a. Coffin Ed Johnson, was in that you would love?
Let me guess. Fire Walk with Me?
He is in that.
Oh, really?
Okay. He's an electrician. But
the electrician.
He's in They Live.
Oh.
Does he play in They Live? Yeah. Oh, shit. Is he really?
Yeah.
Huh. I never would have put that together for some reason.
Yeah, like seeing it right now, it's like, oh, that's definitely him. But like, yeah,
I always think of him. He's in the Bronson movie, Evil That Men Do, was the first thing that came to mind I was going to make. One of Bronson's truly true low points in a career that has a lot of them. But it's really
He's okay with threesome in that. Three's all right with me. A threesome with a black man, I should say.
Yeah, and he's also they made a movie of one of Himes's first novel, If He Hollers, Let Him Go, and he's in that as well, I believe. And that's an interesting novel because that's a very Los Angeles type novel. It actually reminds me in sort of its setting, if not tone, of the E.Z. Rollins novels, of Walter Mosley's E.Z. Rollins novels. It's sort of the same era, those that wave of immigrants, internal immigrants, migrants within the United States, the black people who came to Los Angeles to work in the airline and Air Force industry that was springing up around that time in that era, which is what E.Z. Rollins is getting laid off from doing to become a detective in those books. And If He Hollers, Let Him Go is in the same milieu as that. And Raymond St. Jacques is in the film adaptation of that.
Ooh.
Is that something I can just do? Like, if I lose my job, I'll just, you know, I'm going to become a detective.
He gets kind of roped into it. Hang out in a seedy place and become as known as a guy who's like, can get things done in that area.
The seediest place I hang out is wherever we are when we're recording this podcast. So, you know, I don't. The imaginary world I've just come up with. Never mind.
That's, you know, work that world. Somebody will need to get in there and find their missing daughter at some point.
No. In my notes, I wrote down Black Klansman borrows from this, maybe. But I don't remember what I was referring to.
I mean, I can see that. Obviously, Ossie Davis is a really important figure to Spike Lee and a big touchstone on his career with how many movies of Spike Lee he's in, and, you know, him recreating his own eulogy at Malcolm X's funeral and Malcolm X and things like that. And obviously him being such an important character and do the right thing and representing sort of the older generation in that movie that he was a part of, the of social justice and art and the arts.
And most importantly, he's the judge.
Yeah.
And She Hate Me.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God.
His career defining role.
His last movie, or one of his last movies, She Hate Me.
God. Yeah, I don't even have a joke for She Hate Me.
Movie has no jokes.
It's beyond. See,
that movie made me realize another level of racism in the movie Forrest Gump, because that, you know, there's that whole section where they're talking about the guy who played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who finds the door unlocked in Watergate, right?
Yeah.
And in Forrest Gump, that guy's, you know, it was discovered by Forrest Gump. He's the one who made the call. Yeah. That white guy did it all.
It's true. He called his cousin Marvin Berry to let him know about everything that was happening.
So thanks, She Hate Me. That's what I'm trying to say.
God, it's bumming me out to think that She Hate Me is one of his last movies. In my head, it was just going to be Bubba Ho-Tep was his last movie, because I can't think of anything after that. But now I know it was She Hate Me. Now I gotta live with that. Speaking of fake JFK movies, I'm gonna tie this all in to everything.
Going to the black exploitation thing. Like, also, I forgot to mention this earlier, but I don't know how I feel about the term overall, because like with the exploitation genre, like all the random subgenres within it, none of them are named after a race. It's always like an object or like a occupation or something random. You don't have like Asian exploitation or like Irish exploitation.
Yeah. But
like, and it's kind of a weird thing that I read the Curse Mayfield biography, Traveling Soul, co-written by his son, and Curtis hated the term black exploitation. For that reason.
Yeah.
And Rudy Ray Moore, in a documentary clip I saw, he also hated black exploitation for that very reason, because no other genre gets is named after a whole race, and it's kind of a weird thing.
It is weird, and it's like cutesy. It's like a clever term, too, which makes it like doubly like condescending and gross. You know, it's not even like a dignified phrase. It's not even like black audience cinema, you know, which is fundamentally like neutral. Like calling it blaxploitation feels like, you know, too goddamn cutesy by half for that. But I, you know, the idea of exploitation films, which is really, I think, isn't it Roger Corman who coined the phrase exploitation films, was the idea, you know, of films that have an audience built into them, whatever that audience is, that you can deliver the worst, crummiest movie, and it doesn't matter what the movie is because there's a built-in audience for it, no matter what. And that horror films are, by their nature, exploitation films, and that sort of thing. You know, obviously the combination of black and exploitation is unpalatable as well from a racial perspective. That something about that doesn't sit well, that you have so many white filmmakers in the genre too, predominantly white filmmakers making these films that exploit black audiences.
And, well, there's William Crane, but that was kind of it.
And Ossie Davis, if you want to call this a black exploitation film, you know, and Melvin Van Peebles, if you want to call those exploitation films, you know.
Yeah. And there are like some scattered others, but it's, you know, mostly just white people.
Yeah.
Like even like Boss Nigger is directed by Jack Arnold.
Yeah. No, and a lot of them that had come out of like the Corman school of cheap B movies. You know, there are a lot of people like Jack Arnold like that clearly have no special affinity for this shit. That if you have, you know, Richard Fleischer and, you know, people like that making these movies. Even people I like George Armitage, did a blaxploitation film. You know, he did Hitman. and it's sort of hard to figure out why him. And the answers to the question have nothing to do with, like, because he'd be a really good fit. Bernie Casey wanted to work with him or something like that. You know, it's.
Yeah. You mentioned Richard Fleischer. Mandingo is a strange movie.
I don't know why that was the first one that popped in my head here, why I was thinking of that. You know?
And Drum is garbage and not worth anyone's time.
Yeah.
Even though it has a better cast, I think Mandingo is the better movie. But we will not do episodes on those movies. I really don't feel like watching those a second time.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you have. There's also this kind of thing where it's like our Sidney Poitier's movies, blaxploitation, the ones he makes in that era, that feels like a very gross word to slap on him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That feels like, you know, just in poor taste in some way. But is that condescending to say that blaxploitation films built for black audiences can't have dignity, can't be tasteful, can't be made by Sidney Poitier's, you know? And, you know, maybe that's something I should be reconsidering when I'm defining it inside my head.
Yeah.
Let's just eliminate the term.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's important, I think, to point out when there was a movement to make these movies and a thing happening, that there was an artistic movement happening at this moment in time. I think it's important to categorize them in that way, to remember that this was going on and look at it through that lens to preserve some of that historical context for it and understanding. You know, yeah. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to do that, but come up with a better term.
Yeah, just, I don't know. I have a complicated relationship with the term.
Yeah.
But on the note of history, Calhoun at the end of the movie, Cotton Comes to Harlem, he's in blackface.
Yep. And when it gets the mask, like, gets pulled off.
Yeah, that's. So, that's not how is that how blackface works? Were they wearing physical masks? Because
No.
Traditionally, it's burnt cork, and you put like lotion on your face to protect the skin, and you use this burnt cork with like a makeup sponge.
Yep.
Okay. Well, a follow-up question: did he bring that from home?
I felt like that was a nod in some way to what that character is in the book, who's more like an overtly race-baiting character in the book. But I don't fucking know. It's just an interesting idea in the movie, as opposed to.
And he gets exposed, his black, like the blackface thing is, it gets like exposed in front of a black audience, which is cathartic and, you know, and like a threat to, you know, the history of blackface and.
Yeah,
in entertainment and
on stage.
That.
Yeah, it's on stage where he's on blackface. Although we're talking about how the movie isn't broad, he then gets wheeled up with the scenery background and like kicks his feet in some way. This movie's right on the border of being too goofy. Although I really like this movie, it comes as close to being too goofy as you can get without being too goofy.
Yeah, and So before we finish discussion, do you guys have like a favorite moment or like a joke moment or like gag from the movie?
I like when he's when they're springing Iris out of jail, and the cop that she's already deceived doesn't recognize her as being part of the congregation that's come to see the imprisoned minister who's left. But just when
what's wrong with that old biddy?
Yeah, but just when I love when Gravedigger gives like the sarcastic my people," I just fucking love the way he says that line, as they're like, you know, making a fool out of this guy. Although the stepping on the ribs is great, and also in that scene where the guy gets his wallet stolen and he has two plates of food and doesn't know how to take it back, so they just stick it in his mouth. I love that joke too. I also love the shootout at the very beginning when the guys show up with the machine guns. Their outfits are fucking awesome, which is important for a heist movie. the awesomeness of the heisters' outfits, and just like it gets like real really quick, you know, like when they start shooting off, it's fucking great too. So yeah, I love
it's
that.
Great tone setter, because you have you have the cops, Gravedigger and Coffin, and you have like the joke with the wallet, and then it's like, oh fuck, people are dying.
Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah, you don't know what kind of movie you're ending up with at that point. Like I said, I didn't know what I was walking into, but it was kind of silly in the beginning, and then it's like, yeah, people getting killed, and then actually pretty great car chase. And it's like, what's going on with this movie? Who's the main character? When is Cotton gonna show up?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm going through it, and most of my favorite stuff is from that opening scene, like where Red Fox doesn't have enough money to buy the share on the Ark to take him back to Africa, and Deke shows up and waves off the fee. But also just the whole way it's shot, where, you know, like down this woman's blouse, where like that's the other way they're working the crowd, is just like these beautiful young women taking the money as well. Just like every angle of this, dressed in like the pure virginal white, and are just so like clear-eyed, good Christian girls, but they're also so overtly selling sex at the same time, I think is a very knowing and intelligent thing, which makes that dance sequence at the end all the more inexplicable and hard to understand what he's getting at.
For me, my favorite moments would be the joke at the end with Red Fox and like the Harry Potter picture.
Oh my god.
I moved to Ghana that, and I'm surrounded by three beautiful women.
That reminds me of Scatman Crothers on Vacation in The Shining. I see it, where he's in the bed with like the naked woman over top of him.
He's got one on either side. Yeah. Because there's one behind him, and then when we see the TV, there's one on that wall too.
Yeah.
That's great.
There's the line during the police interrogation with Deke O'Malley, where one of them, I didn't write down, but one of them takes a cigar and says, "That's police brutality." And like Coffin or Greger says, "That's cancer prevention."
Yeah, I mean, those cops are great. Like, have you guys seen the sequel? Is it any good?
The sequel is terrible. The sequel is F minus terrible. That's maybe not that, but it's also, you know, based on one of the books, but it's a real stinker. And it's a good example of, you know, what a filmmaker brings to something, because Ossie Davis quit. He was supposed to direct it, but Come Back Charleston Blue, but could not come to an agreement with the producers and left. And it's boring, and there's no humor, and it's uglier than it needs to be. And it's the book isn't called Come Back Charleston Blue. Spencer, help me out here. What's the book it's based on called?
I can look up right now. I was looking up Carl Lockhart, who played Deke O'Malley. He's in Predator too, as King Willie.
Yeah. Oh wow!
Yeah, he's Jamaican.
Yeah, he's part of the evil Los Angeles Jamaican gang.
No, but in real life, Carl was Calvin was Jamaican.
Calvin Lockhart.
The
movie,
Heat's On.
Jamaican too.
The Heat's On is the novel it's based on.
Oh okay, yeah, I couldn't remember the title, but
yeah, and my other. Another moment I like was the fight at like the junkyard with the flare gun.
Oh yeah,
so beautifully.
Another really
done.
Good shootout. Yeah,
yeah, that shootout is good, because that's a shootout that gets that again is like a little bit funny, but then is also suddenly very violent.
I am. I like the whole after the Rev gets arrested. Scene where people start gathering outside.
Yeah.
And like I was feeling incredibly sensitive to, like, you know, those the religious group shows up first with the food for the Rev, but you know they've got a small crowd following along with them because they're making noise, and all the
white
cops
with a drunk
immediately
in
go
it.
There's a riot outside.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah, get out the riot guns, potential riot. I also love that there's a drunk in that group who's like walking with them. There's like a tipsy guy with a bottle who's just joined it. That scene is great too. And the hippies who show up, and every time they try and get involved, the rest of the crowd is like, "Who the fuck asked you?"
White boy.
Yeah.
And the poor guy with his old, you know, cart full of chickens, he can't stop it. All of a sudden, all his chickens are flying in the air.
Yes. This film features more awkward shots of things being thrown in the air. Homeless men, black militants, chickens, than any movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. And you just reminded me of the whole pickpocket guy once again. When he... You know, first when he gets stopped, like, all the stuff is played for comedy, and his partner is distracting that lady when he's trying to cut open her dress to steal, I guess, money she's got tied to her leg or whatever.
That's directly from the book, too.
And he gets hit by the car and flies through the air, and it's really funny, but it's like, oh, he died. Like,
yeah.
Whoa!
Yeah, that dude's dead now.
Yeah, I mean, and in the book, it's much more graphic.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
There's in a lot of the books, there's people getting hit by cars in the books. Apparently, like, be more careful, pedestrians in Harlem, because that's a lot of what they deal with.
So, 1970 had a lot of movies come out, it turns out. So, I'm going to recommend very few. I'm trying to keep it concise. One is Brewster McCloud, Robert Altman. It's kind of a weird comedy drama, like coming-of-age story.
It is critical negligence to describe that movie as a comedy. That is, people are going to expect a single funny thing to happen in it, describing it that way.
I don't know how to explain it, besides it's the first movie with Shelley Duvall, The Love of My Life, ex-wife in another dimension, Lifetime. But it's the first movie with her, and it's just this weird movie about a bird angel woman, I guess. And I don't know how to explain it. It needs to be seen to be experienced.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious, is what you're saying.
No, there's some funny parts.
It's funny, it's charming, it's fast-paced, it makes sense. All of these things, Joel.
All right.
If you love Altman, it's necessary to see. But if you don't love Altman, I don't know.
I actually feel like if you like fantastical, modern, fable-ish type things, you might be more open to it than if you like Altman. But yeah. I know plenty of Altman fans who like it, certainly in the context of adoring Altman. But I'm a pretty big Altman fan, and boy, do I hate that movie.
Well, I'm kind of biased because it's Shelley Duvall.
Yeah.
But there's that, and I was on the Grind Bin in February talking about A Shallow that I'm a fan of, even though it's garbage and kind of hard to find now. But In the Folds of the Flesh, it's very confusing. It gets into, like, Nazi exploitation. It gets into, like, incest, and, like, it's kind of a riff on Psycho to an extent, and Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
Texas Chainsaw didn't come out yet. But there's some Texas Chainsaw elements to it a bit. But it's just this insane, like, murder. I don't know how. Not even murder mystery. It's just this family drama, I get. Have you seen it, Chris?
No, I haven't, and I've never heard of it before now. I'm not much of a Giallo fan, so... there's a lot, if it's even slightly off the beaten path, I probably haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's understandable. It's just, if you're curious and you love Giallo or like weird movies, I say seek it out. And what's this episode of Grindbin on Infolds of Flesh? We have a fun time trying to understand what the fuck the movie is trying to be. But that's it. J-Dog, well, Chris, or do you want to go?
You guys tell me.
Go ahead, Chris.
The 1970 movies I'm going to recommend are The Honeymoon Killers, the great Honeymoon Killers, which is, you know, based on a true story of the Raymond Fernandez and Martha Beck, the Lonely Hearts Killers. This is what the phrase I'm looking for. It's directed by a famously one-time director, Leonard Castle, who's like a theater director. It's also notorious for Martin Scorsese directed some of it that ended up in the movie before he was fired. He says he was only on the shoot for, I think, one day is what he says. And it's a movie that's popular for massive Scorsese fans to watch and declare that they are absolutely certain that must be the scene that Scorsese shot, you know, no matter what scene it is. It's truly excellent. It's one of the great, queasy, weird, like exploitation horror film thriller type things of the 70s. It's a movie I love a lot. It stars the great Shirley Stoller, who I think, you know, if you know her, you probably know her from Seven Beauties. She has a small role in Miami Blues, but she's amazing in this movie. She's really, really phenomenal. And
the Seven Beauties, the Lena Wertmuller movie?
Yeah, the Lena Wertmuller movie about the guy during World War II who ends up in a prison camp, the Italian guy who's just trying to get through it. She's like the cruel Nazi guard that he's trying to seduce to have an easier time in the prison camp. And she's phenomenal in this movie. She's absolutely phenomenal in this movie. And she's an actress that was undoubtedly fucked over because she's overweight. She's like a fat lady. And she's a phenomenal actress and just never got a shot. This movie should have made her as big of a star as there is. And she got held back because of fucking waitist assholes, whatever the word is for it, out in Los Angeles. And Leonard Castle also seems to have gotten screwed over in some way on this. He I don't think had a happy experience either. He was one of Truffaut's very favorite films. He used to give all kinds of quotes about it, just like as it being one of his very favorites, over the top kind of quotes. But it's excellent. If you haven't seen it, see it. There's a Criterion edition. If you're one of those, you know, fucking Criterion humpers, get in line, get this movie, you know?
That's me.
Exactly. If you're one of those people that just is going to get a boner when you hear Blu-ray, like, go for Honeymoon Killers. It's got amazing packaging art. I'm also 1970, great Lee Marvin Western Death of the West movie called Monte Walsh with Lee Marvin and Jean Moreau and Jack Palance. And it's about, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. Cowboys, ranchers, you know, aging cowboys as the West is sort of dying out from being that thing. And
wait, Jack Palance from Hawk the Slayer?
I was going to say Jack Palance from Tango and Cash, but you can do whatever you want.
Joel, is he from Hawk the Slayer?
Yes, he's the villain in Hawk the Slayer and is amazing in that movie.
Yeah, he's not doing the full bananas Jack Palance thing in this. He's doing real acting. And it's, you know, it's great. It's like an a Gaelic type Western, you know, of that.
Hold All on right, what'd you do?
I live right across the street from a fire station. Yeah, and it's wonderful. It's just like a lovely movie, and it's a lovely Lee Marvin movie. You know, Lee Marvin's one of my very favorite actors, and he's seen as like the classic tough guy stuff is what he's remembered for, but he does a lot of more sort of plaintive and sad kind of roles than he gets credit for, I think. And this is one of the truly great ones that he did, and Jean Moreau's great in it too. If you haven't seen it, see it. That one, I don't think there's any criterion of. The director, I don't even remember who directed it. William Fraker directed it.
Oh, so no one's going to get an erection about it. Okay.
Yeah, you know, if you're like somebody who has a podcast about whether things are criterion worthy or not, you know, you probably can't get excited for this.
Damn.
I know. It's very sad. It's very sad. I got two more for 1970. Is that okay? Is that too much?
Absolutely.
Oh, Lord.
Have
I'm just looking at Marcello Mastroianni movies right now.
There's good ones. He made a few good ones. I'm going to recommend the Jean-Pierre Melville movie Le Cirque Rouge from 1970. It's a late period Melville. It's one of his great heist films. I don't know what there is to be said about it other than that. I've done several Melville podcasts. I don't a lot of desire.
You did an epic one for Wrong Wheel a while ago.
Oh, yeah. We did Wrong Wheel. And that one's pretty good. And that has, like, our long-lost friend and collaborator, Eric Frender, on it, too, with me and John. So seeing him come out of the wild was nice on that. That was a fun one. That one, I think, went pretty well. And Cirque Rouge, it's great. But I don't know more to say. Jean-Pierre Melville, heist film. See it. One of his, really good ones. Maybe his best color film. But probably not. And then the last one I'm going to quote-unquote recommend is a movie called Rider on the Rain from the French director René Clément, who I mentioned Truffaut earlier. René Clément was like one of Truffaut's very favorite punching bags, just like Truffaut has a quote to the effect of like he represents the worst tendency towards phony intellectualism in French cinema. He loved to hammer the hell out of this guy. And these quotes that are like, everything that the French New Wave is rebelling against is in René Clément. René Clément has no talent except as an imitator. These kind of quotes, you know. And he did, his most famous movie is Purple Noon, Plein Soleil, with Alain Delon, based on Patricia Highsmith's Talented Mr. Ripley. It's a great movie that's an utterly terrible adaptation of a much better book. And Clément made, you know, I'm setting all this up, Truffaut, Alain Delon, high art. He made a Charles Bronson movie in 1970 with René Clément, produced by the great Serge Silverman, too. And I don't even know how to fucking explain this movie. It's like a... It's like a dream narrative. You know, we're talking Robert Altman. It's a little like Three Women or something where who's crazy, whose mind has been broken, that kind of thing. And there's, to give you a sense of the tastelessness of this movie and how out of its mind it is, there is a rapist in this movie who does a lot of raping, and that character's name is MacGuffin. So, yeah, and it's like, it's just the kind of movie that's like, you know, people quote Lewis Carroll in a Charles Bronson movie.
Is that how he met Jill, or are they together?
By 70? My God, I wish I was enough of a Bronsonologist to know when they met. I don't think it's where they met. Is it? It's famous for some reason. Other than me being like, this is an impressively terrible miscalculation of a movie. and it is. It's that gets thrown around a lot these days, I feel like. Like, man, this bad movie is batshit crazy how bad it is. And then there's like one scene that's kind of weird, you know? This is a movie that you just can't imagine what anybody is thinking making this movie. Just the mix of elements is so profoundly unpalatable, you know, that even if, you know, it's like mustard on ice cream, it's just like, what is this? So, see Rider on the Rain, unlike Le Cirque Rouge, again, there's no fancy DVD edition of it that I'm aware of. It might have never been on DVD. And it's...
Rider on the Rain is on Amazon Video for $5 to rent.
Worth it. Absolutely worth it. If you don't like it, Spencer will give you your $5 back. Just send him a screenshot of you disliking it, and he will give you the money.
Heard it here first.
No, Joel, you have more money than me. You can do it.
Send Joel screenshot.
I'll send you $5.
Send him. This is what you have to do to get the $5. You have to record yourself watching the entire movie and not enjoying it at all. And exactly. Once you've recorded that, where you derive no enjoyment or pleasure from it, and you're not surprised and appalled by it, then Joel will send you $25, five times the rental fee.
Yep. You send that to me on in a VHS copy so that I can play it at home because I don't have any modern technology.
Yes. And he except will
for podcasting equipment, apparently.
He will pay you in Criterion Blu-rays.
Exactly. Yeah, a $5 Criterion Blu-ray, which is like I have to cut one in half at least.
Exactly. Exactly. Just the cover art.
All right. J-Dog, you got anything? Didn't cover any movies from 1970 on Please Don't Send Me Outer Space?
Yeah. I'm going to talk about all the things that we've covered. Like You and Me, for instance, on the previous incarnation of this podcast, the High and Low Kurosawa podcast. Yeah. 1970, Dodeska Den.
Yeah.
That's a...
It's a hit or miss.
Yeah, I like it because it's the outlier, but it's also a weird misfire.
Yeah. I'm in favor it in the context of this conversation we're having, that this is a good one to throw into the mix.
Right. Yeah, it's not my favorite. Like, I wouldn't put it on the top half of Kurosawa's films personally, but I still think it's an interesting watch. Much better movie, in my opinion, from that same year is The Scandalous Adventures of Burakan. Tatsuya Nakadai playing a rather childish scoundrel who it's kind of a sexy movie, but it's definitely full of murder and it's just such a fun movie.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd call it incest, but there's a weird moment between a mother and a son.
I mean, you know, it goes there.
That's a weird conversation into a weird moment.
Yeah. That is a lot of fun. I highly recommend that one. As for Please Don't Send Me to Outer Space movies, we've covered two. We covered a movie called Mr. Super Invisible, which stars Dean Jones. And it feels kind of like one of those Disney fun for the whole family type live action movies they used to make in the 70s.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is actually Disney. It's a little just slightly raunchier than than those movies got, but it's not very memorable, not necessarily very fun. But the one that I really do recommend that we covered is The Dunwich Horror, which is stars Dean Stockwell as a crazy person, and it's great to see him just like Dean Stockwell, in my opinion, already has kind of a weird face, but he's doing weird things in the movie with him, his body actions on top of everything else, and he's super young because it's 70, and if you're like me, you're used to the Quantum Leap era. And it's an adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft story, but it has almost nothing to do with that short story other than having the name and, you know, mentions of the Necronomicon and Miskatonic University, I think it's called. But I really recommend it. For some reason, it's disliked by a lot of people. I think it's super fun, especially like in a group environment. And the episode we did on Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space is still one of my favorites. And if you're interested, you can check that stuff out at pdsmios.com.
So, Chris, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. I had a lot of fun. I'm glad to get to talk about this movie. I feel like this movie is somewhat forgotten, and it shouldn't be. It's mm-hmm. worth people's time.
Yeah, hopefully people will watch it after listening to this, or if not after, before.
And also read the book, and read Chester Hines in general.
It's good stuff. It's really good. If you like crime fiction of any kind, you know, John and I, Cribs and I, do a podcast where we talk about pulp genre fiction each month, where we just pick a book. And we always try and pick things that we think are interesting or maybe upbeat or whatever. And we've just been on a run where we haven't necessarily read anything too great. We've read some interesting things. We've read some terrible things. Picking this up to read this again to do the podcast was like, it's fucking phenomenal. Like, if you like crime fiction, this is really good shit. You know, this is not run of the mill or B plus shit. Like Chester Himes is up there. You know, if you like Jim Thompson, Donald Westlake, Charles Williford type stuff, this is on that level. Raymond Chandler, you know, it's Walter Mosley. It's definitely on that level.
Yeah. Let's see, Joel, don't you have a podcast thing?
I mean, I've already talked about
it. Yeah, I've realized that.
There's anything after else to say, but, you know, yeah, if you want to hear me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies, you check out Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space. We're like on a 2-week schedule. Most recently, we did the movie Mute, Duncan Jones straight to Netflix movie, which we all really liked, but once again, very divisive. People seem to not like that movie, but we dug it. Coming soon, Alien 3.
Which version of Alien 3 are you doing?
You know, we started to do the whatever the special edition cut that came out mm-hmm. was. And then Sarah, one of my co-hosts, is pretty sensitive to gore. And apparently most of it was inserts of gore. So we, after the whole dog scene got cut out and replaced with an ox scene, spoiler for that, we switched back over to the regular cut. And it was like, wait, where's the dog scene? What's going on here? I guess we watched more of the regular cut than the other. But I chose that one because I happen to really like Alien 3, and that's another one that people shit all over.
I think all the Alien movies of those first four are all interesting in their own ways, whether or not they're variable quality. It's they're all interesting. They're all worth seeing. I appreciate all four of them, even though, you know, I wouldn't rate any of them on the level with the first one.
Right, that's a different. Yeah, I mean, your standard of even the first two, like even Aliens, like trying to meet up to that standard is incredibly difficult. Yeah. So no, yeah.
But I like the weirdness of Part 3 and the grimness, or the grimness of Part 3 and the weirdness of Part 4. I like that more than the straight ahead action of Part 2. You know, of Aliens. So right. I know I'm definitely in the minority there, but I appreciate, you know. That they tried to do different things with it, and it wasn't just here's the first one again, you know, with the mythology expanded to pass the point of any sense, like, you know, John Wick style.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And for me, I will be on a
Below Freezing with Micah and CJ.
About Cool World, because I find Bakshi to be endlessly fascinating, even when he misfires, which is most of the time.
Yeah, which I was going to say, that which is all of them? Is there a single one that's top to bottom, like, flawless?
No, not for Bakshi.
Yeah.
It's all like, this is a cool scene. This is a weird scene. This is a bad scene.
Yeah, he's got 6 rounds in the chamber, and 3 of them are duds, and 2 are bullseyes, you know? Yeah. Every movie, that's what it is.
Yeah, Alakunskin I will defend as, like, kind of the best one.
Yeah, I think it's certainly the most... He clearly feels like, if I'm going to do this, I can't be as sloppy as I normally am.
Yeah, so, look out.
I saw that because of you. I hadn't seen it until you recommended it to me.
Oh, yeah, it's a fascinating movie. And, I personally like Coonskin, but, like, it's also, the cast also totally works in that.
Yeah.
But, did you like it? Did you find it interesting?
I found it super interesting. I feel like it would be a stone cold classic if a black filmmaker had made it. I feel like with what it is and how incendiary it is, that it's hard to... Even me as an audience just accept it. And also having any context of Bakshi, it's you feel queasy watching it. There's no way not to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's still, I think it should be seen by most people, because it's definitely, it's not bad. It's not like other Bakshi stuff that I've seen that I don't want to name.
Like Cool World. Like Cool World, is that what you're thinking?
Coral is weird, to put it lightly. But anyway, so that's it for me. And you got your podcast, The Pink Smoke, which you can access through the Patreon.
Yeah, the podcast is through the Patreon, although what we're going to start doing is opening up old episodes after they're like a year old or something to general audiences and doing that because we sort of feel, you know, we're trying to balance between making the Patreon worth it and allowing our guests that have come on to be heard by a meaningful audience. So we're trying to strike the right balance with that. So if we do two a month, I think after they're a year old, one of those two will be released. Is what we're going to do.
Okay. And
Patreon subscribers will still be receiving exclusive content accessible only through the Patreon. And they'll be getting early access to everything we do. There you go. There's my pitch voice.
And I highly recommend us being part of Patreon for Pink Smoke. There's a great episode that makes it worth it with Martin Kessler talking about the Eternal Mercenary book series. And I will not spoil anything. It's definitely worth it for that episode alone. But next episode will be Summer Sam.
That episode features me singing, by the way, the Martin Kessler Eternal Mercenary. I sang on that episode. Anyway.
But next up, this pairing for this month is Summer Sam with Rosetta, the can winner, because Joel doesn't want to watch American Beauty, which I understand. But
so, Joel, do you understand the punishment you've just carved out for yourself by watching Rosetta?
No. Better the monster I know than the one I don't. I am in total disagreement of that. So even if this is like a torturous film, I'm still going to be like, my brain is still going to reward me with some sort of weird endorphin. I don't know. That's the way my movie brain works.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. So, and also I feel like you've done a little too many Oscar winners. I want to watch more can winners, but,
Would you call it a laugh a minute though? That's what, you know,
I hope it's better than Shakespeare in Love, but most things are.
What can be? Come on.
I mean, it's a low bar to clear. It's definitely better than all these movies you're listing. But it's, you know. But if you're not into that style, they take that style all the way down the line where it's got to be. They take it just as far as it can go. So if you don't enjoy it 20 seconds in, you are really not going to enjoy it by the time the 2 hours is up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and Joel, I might cut this part out. I have the Netflix disc for Rosetta, so we will record it in time, so you won't have to resort to the Oscar winner this time.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good to me. Thank God.
Yeah, so, Chris, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on. It's always fun to talk to you guys.
Oh, same. And, we'll see you guys next time for either Rosetta or Summer Sam.
Mm-hmm.
See ya.
All right.
How do I don't want to fuck this up on Audacity. I hit the yellow stop button.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com and Spotify and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.